Jewish oral history of Louisville. I'm interviewing Ann Carl, June 20th, 1977. Ann, you were born in Louisville, is that right?
That's right.
Could you tell me how your family happened to come to Louisville?
My parents came from Kovnigaban in Russia. My father came here in the late 1800s. My mother followed later. I think he arrived here because he followed a married sister who lived in Louisville, Kentucky. And he started out as a peddler with a pack on his back around Indiana and Louisville. And since he was a shoemaker by trade, he opened a shoemaking shop. My mother and brother and sister followed later. We lived on Preston Street, which was then, I suppose you'd call, a ghetto. But since there were no such things as cars or telephones or any kind of transportation other than a horse and a wagon, people had to be in the neighborhoods of their businesses and the Jewish butcher shops and the shul. At that time, there was a Rabbi Zarki, who was the rabbi of the B'nai Jacob shul that was spoken of then. And as I recall, the rabbi didn't receive any salary, per se, for his services. The people donated towards his keep. And there was also, I learned as a child, that the people donated small amounts of money into a source or something that called the Gemilas Chesed. And that was supposed to be for the benefit of any Jew who was in need. And he was allowed to borrow the money without interest, but it was compulsory morally that he paid back the money that he borrowed. That was before the days of your community chest and things of that sort. And then women got together and formed a group called the Ladies Hebrew Society, which helped out the needy. And if there was a sudden urge or somebody came into town and had no help of any kind, clothes, place to live, or food, some of the Jewish women would go about to each one and ask for what they called an adobe. They didn't say who it was for, and they gave what little money they could, and they helped. And that was the way their charities began before the Jewish Federation took hold, when there were more needy Jews to be taken care of. I went to the Louisville schools and the Louisville Girls High School and University of Louisville. It didn't seem to be important at that time that you give girls Hebrew education. The boys were educated in Hebrew so that they could be bar mitzvahed.
Ann, do you remember much about what sort of homes you all had at that point? I sound like, you know, tell me about the good old, the old olden days.
Well, yeah, according to today's figure, it wouldn't be considered good old days. I suppose you'd say that that was very hard living, but since we had nothing to compare it to, I suppose it was all right, as they say. I may have been an underprivileged child, but I didn't know what that meant, and I wasn't aware of it, so I wasn't particularly bothered with it. We had books. We didn't have, even the schools didn't give books in those days. We had to buy the books or hand them down from one child to another, and there was no great difficulty in a large family unless they changed the books at that time. But there seems to have been sort of a camaraderie that Jews had to help Jews. And there were very few needy Jews at that time that stayed in need, because someone always shared with him what they had. When the Federation came into being, that was another source that they could turn to. But there wasn't a great amount of money, as far as I knew. The type of Jew that I was acquainted with at that time was not a wealthy person.
Ann, did you go to Sunday Sabbath school? Did you have it on Saturday or Sunday? Or
the one shul did not have a Sunday school at that time. I think what was then known as the YMHA, it was located on South First Street. And one or two times they attempted a Sunday school there, but there seemed to be trouble holding on to a teacher, so it was never a very, there was no continuity to it. You went one Sunday and then nobody was there the next Sunday to hold school. But there were little clubs. I myself belonged to they called it the Grace Aguilar Circle. And we met on Sunday. I'm not quite sure now what we did when we met, if it was social or if we learned. But there were various activities. Now this is later in the century. This is not in the early 1900s. This is already going up to probably 1910, 11, 12, something like that. When the center afterwards, it was called the YMHA at that time, moved to Second and College, I think, or Second in New York. And was it seemed at that time to be a very large place, but it soon outgrew its location because the activities became more. And then there was another congregation that started called the Besmeger Sagudel. And then because there were some Jews who had located in the West End around 11th or 12th Street, and it was too far them to walk on Saturdays or the holidays to the shul, they formed another congregation there. And there was also a congregation, it was the first one that Rabbi Gilman came to, at Floyd and Chestnut, which is now the location of the Children's Hospital.
Do you remember how they formed the Adventist Shurim? How it started, they decided to start another congregation?
Adventist Shurim, I don't think, started another congregation, because I remember it as far back as, I remember being in three locations. And they were probably the Jews who thought that the Orthodox was a little bit too rigid, and they wanted a little more lenient form of services and religion. And the one thing being that they preferred having the women sit with the men. That was the first breakaway.
Do you remember much about the start? Were the present women's organizations like Hadassah, Council, etc., how many of those were back? Do you remember the starts of many of those?
I think the Hadassah started in somewhere around 1912 with people like Mrs. Barnett Linker and Aunt Betty Ades, as they called her, Mrs. Jacob Ades, and Sadie Walcall and Sadie Bear. As I recall, those are the names that come to mind, that they were originators of the... In fact, I once saw the minutes of that first meeting.
That should have been interesting. Do you remember much about them?
No, other than that they were to help... it wasn't Israel then, it was Palestine. And their idea of farming, of first farming, was that they had a sewing circle where they would meet and... make clothes to send over there. It was long before the start of the State of Israel. And there was a family by the name of, he was always called B. Isaacs, he was the grandfather of Dr. Ivram Isaacs and Arthur Isaacs. And they were my idea of the first Zionistic family in the city of Louisville. In fact, I think I heard the word from them. I had an older brother who was friendly with Miss Minnie Isaacs, she was then, and there was a Lizzie Isaacs and Louis Isaacs. I don't know that any of that older family or any of them are alive right now. I don't know them. But they were very active and there was a Goldstein family, Hattie Goldstein, I think they're relatives of yours.
Oh.
Joe's, yes. And they were very interested. In fact, I think it was Hattie Goldstein who led this Grace Aguilar Circle, of which I was a member. And as the city grew and streetcars came into being, horse cars first, I don't recall those, and then the streetcars. And I suppose it was easier, or we walked, which was very good. I can remember walking from where I lived to the YMHA, as it was called then.
Was it on
on 2nd Street, 2nd and, what do they call it, York or College Avenue? It's right in back of the, what's now the Stauffer Inn.
Yeah.
And there was a Mr. Charlie Morris, who was a lawyer. And he was very much interested in arts and tried to bring culture to the YMHA. He instituted a declamatory contest, and I think he was the one that gave the prizes, and the younger men and women would try out for these contests. And they had basketball teams who originated then.
Even in those days, the Y was the center, our community center is now.
Now, yes.
The center of most of the Jewish. I've heard you tell about a hall of some sort where weddings were held.
That was not a Jewish, that was a German, I think that belonged to the Germans. It was called the Liederkranz Hall, where weddings were held. In fact, your husband's mother got married there at that hall. And I remember my father going to the laying of the cornerstone of the original Jewish hospital at Floyd in Kentucky. I don't recall where it originated before that, but I remember.
Was that the first Jewish hospital?
As far as I can remember, maybe there was some nucleus of it before, but I can't recall anything like that. But it was small, and then it grew in stature, and they added a nurse's home, and they added on to it until they moved to their new location.
And back to Hadassah.
Yeah.
It must seem like a whole new and different organization today. Can you discuss some of the changes in it?
Well, I don't think its basic principle has changed. It was always a woman Zionist organization. Their purpose was always to work for Zionism, but Zionism finally evolved into the State of Israel, so you can't speak of Zionism anymore because they achieved their purpose. But their main purpose was always humanitarian, and the hospital was their strong point. They worked for the hospital, to build a hospital and to finance it and to keep it in supplies. But of course, when the war came on and the Jews were being destroyed, then Youth Aliyah became their big thing. Their purpose then was to save the children and bring them into Israel. So I think more of their efforts went into saving. And after you saved the children and brought them into Israel, then you had to build the schools and teach them to be good citizens of the State of Israel when it evolved. But their purpose was always humanitarian. I think it still stays that way. They don't branch off from that.
And in the early days of Hadassah, or even the first was just a sewing circle, I believe you said.
What it seemed to me. I don't know.
As well as you remember. Then in the early days when they became Hadassah and affiliated nationally, what sort of meetings did they have?
Well,
do you remember?
I go back. I joined. I think I became a Hadassah member back in 1923, somewhere around about that time. And I don't recall too much. I became active in it in around 1947, and from then on, of course, I can speak a little more knowledgeable about it. But until then, I really don't know whether it was a social. I know that they were always raising money, and the monies all went to Palestine. And they also were the collection point for the Blue Box, although in those days people went from door to door. There was a sort of a Blue Box day when they went from door to door, and either people kept the little Blue Box in the house and they opened it, or you donated the money, or they pinned a little blue and white flag on you when you gave them money. But it always seemed to me a money-raising proposition, as far as I can recall.
And do you remember much about
before the anecdotes that your father told you about his trip over here, or the first days he was here, that, you know, when he started out here, or before he got here?
Before he got here.
Or, you know,
no, he didn't do too much talking about before he got here. His life, he was very young, and he should have gone in the Russian army, so he was trying very hard to get out of the country and to evade going into the army. And after he got here, living was very rough. I remember until this past winter was the first time I ever heard of the Ohio River freezing up, other than when he told me about it back in the late 1800s. I think they said it was 100 years or more before they had seen the Ohio River frozen.
That was before you were born?
Yes.
Do you remember any special anecdotes you'd like to recall from your childhood?
Well,
that illustrates, you know, life in Louisville.
I think that what interested me most is I'd stand there and watch these women come in and say to him, "Mr. Simons, I'm a dove, please." And I didn't know what it meant, but I saw him reach in his pocket and give him some change, and away they went. And I wanted to know what it was for. And he said, "It's for charity. And if you know the name of the person, it's not charity that you're doing." He says these women give of their time, and they're very honorable, and they collect, and they will take care of some poor needy family, but it wasn't necessary for us to know who the family was. And that's my first introduction to the word nadove.
Were you ever active in any other organizations in Louisville?
Active? I don't know how active. Well, in the shul.
Yeah,
I was on the board of the shul. And when they originally started the Brandeis Women and the Hospital Guild and the Council of Jewish Women Sisterhood.
You've been in them all. And what do you feel are the significant changes since you're in, you know, over the years in the city and in the community?
Oh, they're almost too huge to talk about in the changes. I think the center is going to be a very attractive place, and they've gone in all directions to teach and to bring culture along with entertainment such as swimming. Whoever heard of a Jewish center with a swimming pool that you have now, indoor and outdoor swimming pools, and the places to reduce in the gymnasium because we overeat. There's more food around now than there was back then.
Well, didn't the Jewish mama always say we overate?
Yes, but it was, I suppose it was mostly bread then. It was really the staff of life. And the rabbi, in those days, I recall, the rabbi was the hub. If anybody had troubles, they went to Rabbi Zarkey, and he was a very honorable man. And he probably was our first psychiatrist, as far as I know. He settled all the arguments between husbands, wives, and children, and parents. I think the changes have been very significant, all for the better, I would say.
You think it's better today?
Oh, much better, and still getting better.
That's encouraging. Scott, what I was going to ask you.
I think the Jewish community is very outstanding right now. Maybe the coming of Israel gave us a better face, but I think we all like to voice the fact that we're Jewish now. We don't evade it. We feel that if there's honor due us for what we have done.
Anne, do you remember, when you were young, did you feel much? I know you had plenty, going to public school, you had lots of contact with non-Jewish kids. But what was the relationship between them then? Do you remember? Between the children.
There was never any trouble between the children. It was when they'd go home and learn what a Jew was, that they'd come back and start arguments and start fights. I don't think children ever, they have to be taught to hate each other. I don't think children are born with any.
And you didn't, y'all didn't have too many problems in that area.
Yes, there were arguments. Or one would say Christ killer or something or other like that once in a while. But there wasn't too much of that. You sat alongside them in school and went to school. Of course, in those days, the schools were segregated. We didn't go with the colored children. But I don't know that I felt too much until not until the coming of the Second World War, or back into the 30s when Hitler began to rise into power, that you felt.
Did you feel at that time that there was some spread over here of that creed, Nazism?
Oh, yes.
You did?
Definitely. I remember I used to always worry about there was a place at Brooklyn Market Street. It was called the Superior Welding Company. The windows were always painted dark. I always wondered what went on in that place. And I remember one time, there was a man here in Louisville who was in the insurance business, Mr. Lewis Cohn. He was very well known. And he was quite active in the B'nai B'rith at that time, and he would call on us for insurance. And I asked him about this place once, and he told me that they were very well aware that this was some sort of a Nazi machinations going on, but there was nothing they could do until this country went to war. And it seemed kind of ridiculous to me at the time, if they knew it, why they couldn't do something about it. But I learned very suddenly the day of December 7th, 1941, this was one of the first places they pounced on and locked them up. And at that time they were living in the, not the Willow Terrace, the other big...
Dartmouth?
The Dartmouth. And that place was completely wired with all sorts of contraptions and all. And this man, his wife and her brother or something...
What was their name? Bodenhouse or something?
Bodenschatz. I was thinking Viola was her first name, Bodenschatz. And they went to jail for that. But the B'nai B'rith was very alert at that time at what was going on. But it seemed that when they contacted the Jews in Germany, that they didn't seem to think that they were, that was the whole trouble, I suppose. They didn't seem to think that they were in any danger.
They never did.
No, they thought it was a passing phase and it would go over with, see, that it wouldn't make any difference. And I think It was back in 38 or 39 that the Jewish community, Jewish, what's the one?
Federation?
Not the Federation, the big drive that goes on.
UJA?
The UJA really came into power and existence. That's my first, because I started out in 1938 or 39 to Canvas Farm when people weren't very well aware. We used to go around with a box and ask them to take a box and put 10 cents a week in it, see, to give $5 a year to the, they were people who had never heard, who had never given. And people have to be taught to give. They don't give freely. You have to go after them to give or scare them a little bit. I remember one woman, I told her, well, she dropped a dime in there. I said, that's insurance for Hitler, against Hitler. And I think she thought I was nuts at the time.
Don't get too far away.
But I was frightened at what I had heard at these meetings where they were coaching us and telling us what to do when we went out on the streets, and from then on it grew and grew.
In those early days when you went out on the streets, did they bring, and when they were doing you, training you, preparing you to go out and solicit, did they bring in speakers to train you, or local people do it? How was that?
I think it was local people that did it at first. They weren't so big on it themselves, you know.
Yeah, they didn't know how to start, really, did they?
No, but they, as I look back now, I think they did a very good job for being as green as they were in the effort. But there were a lot of people. See, I can't recall. The Coles were very active in it then. And the Levi's, they're all mostly gone now. James Levi and Stuart and the others, speaking of the other generation, although these younger ones have all taken hold too, they deserve credit for what they're doing. Because it gets a little bit rough on you at my stage of the game to go climbing stairs, you know, maybe to get a...
Well, nowadays, I don't believe they go out and climb stairs. I believe they have meetings mostly,
yeah,
don't they?
Yeah, meetings, and they have educated the people to the fact that they must give. That it isn't all just giving going to Israel. You have to support your centers and your YMHAs, and Four Courts comes under. There was no Four Courts at that time either, you know, in those days. That didn't start till much, much later.
Do you remember what prompted Four Courts to start?
Yes, I suppose that it was, I think it was a dream of Mrs. Barnett Linker. I think that was one of her dreams. And I don't recall too well, but somehow I have a feeling that she was the original instigator of a place like that. And there were quite a few families and people that needed that sort of a place to go to. And not only that they needed this place to go to, but they needed to educate the people that you can't keep all people at home or find homes for them when they're not capable of taking care of themselves and have no family to look after them. So it is quite a nice, one of our nice features that we can brag about.
What do you really think is our, over the years, that the Jewish community has made the greatest strides in? Is there anything in particular that stands out?
Well, the overall picture is pretty, I think. I don't know what could you stand out. You've got a beautiful hospital, you've got a beautiful center, you even got a beautiful club if you can afford to belong to it. And you have Four Courts, which is constantly growing. You have Hebrew schools, you have Jewish day schools. In the war years, there was a, that I went with, that was called, what did they call it, they still called it Benevolent or whatever it was, but we used to go out to Fort Knox and visit the hospitals there.
That was a very good organization.
Yes, I used to belong to it.
Yeah. Was it Ladies Benevolent Society?
I think it was a Ladies Benevolent
Society. Jewish
Ladies
Society?
Yeah, Jewish Ladies
Something
Benevolent
like
Society.
That.
It was disbanded after the war. But I think that Louisville Jewelry has made quite a, look at our beautiful shuls. And now we're going to build another a new one. If our religion keeps up with the beauty of the shul, we'll be all right.
Do you, was there before the present day school, don't remember exactly when it began,
yes.
Has there always been a Jewish day school in Louisville?
No, there was no Jewish day school. There was a Louisville Hebrew school.
But they only taught the boys Hebrew?
They only taught the boys Hebrew.
So they could be bar mitzvah,
that's
and that
right.
was it.
That was it. Girls didn't go there. But there was, no, the day school is the latter day, maybe the last 20 years.
I didn't know how long it had been.
Something like that. But I would say that we've made great strides in Louisville.
Do you know how the Jewish day school started? Or what started it?
What started it? Well, I think a few of the ultra-religious families thought that their children weren't getting good enough Jewish education in the public schools, and they wanted to stress that. It was their privilege. Living in America, we can do it.
I just didn't know whether if there was some particular thing that started it off or...
No, I don't think
it was. It was the aftermath?
It was before desegregation, so it had nothing to do with that. It didn't start as some of these church schools have started recently. No,
well, that's nice
that.
To know.
Yes.
And do you remember your friends of long ago? Some here and some aren't, huh?
Yes.
Any of them you'd like to tell us about?
Well, none that comes to mind real quickly. There are quite a few nice ones that did a lot of good work in the community. I think the Rosenblum family, I used to laugh because the Rosenblum, the ones that were the Enro Shirt Company, I don't think any of them are here right now, of that generation. They were one of the top workers, or original workers, in the UJA. And then afterwards, somebody got the bright idea when they were running the community chess campaign and making very, very little money from the entire community of Louisville. I think it was Bernard Rosenblum.
Yeah, either
they elected him as the chairman one year, And he went after, just like he did the UJA, and really built a machine that's still going strong right now. They raise much, much more money now. You know, these people would give you $10 when it was stupid. They went after him for much more money. He had it all departmentalized, and he really gave it a big plug. So he showed them how to gather money for the city at large.
The Jewish community then has really, that's one example of how the Jewish community has really contributed in a big way to the non-Jewish, to the total community.
I think I see now in the paper where they want to start, somebody's trying to start the Conference of Christians and Jews again. Well, that started back, many years ago, and Aaron and I went to one of their dinners. And I got busy counting the tables that we had there, and I counted that there were more tables of Jews than there were of the Gentiles, and I didn't think that if they showed that little interest, I didn't know why they would want to go on with it again. Suddenly spoke up. He says, "The reason the Jews didn't get a good meeting going. So when I noticed this in my paper the other day, I'd like to tell the man who started it to get an idea like that, maybe they'd listen to him."
I didn't know since they weren't having him anymore. About 2 or 3 years then.
Nobody seemed to take them. Maybe they had them, but it was very small. But I know that we almost showed, you know, most of the Jews at that time showed up in mosques, but we outnumbered the...
We've had quite a few people, honored Jewish people, honored with the conference,
Christians
and Jews.
And by the same token, we have honored a few of the non-Jews.
There have been a lot of non-Jews who've earned the same, and they've earned it.
That's right. And the Club 60, I think that they've given, I don't know of any Gentile organizations that started the senior citizens clubs until this Club 60 started. And there was a woman in Louisville here at the time by the name of Till Mars. She was a newcomer to Louisville. She didn't stay long, but she certainly left her mark before she left. In fact, she was the first one way back, mercy me, it must be 20 years ago, that she went around to the movie houses at that time and got them to issue cards so that senior citizens could go to the movies for 50 cents instead of paying the top price. And finally, that has spread all over the country. In fact, all the other movie houses have taken it up. And she started the Club 60. And then I noticed that all the churches and all beyond that, not only churches but neighborhoods like the Brown Memorial on Brown's Lane, that has a huge one that goes on now. And those have become very, very lovely centers for people to find people of their own age to be with and of their own ideas and thinking.
Well, was she one of the spirits behind starting Senior House in town?
I'm sure she was.
Because I know that was started with councilwoman.
Yes.
A $10,000 request.
Yes.
But was Till one of the stars of starting that?
She was.
She was quite a girl.
She was quite a girl, is right. It was a loss to Louisville when she left here.
And I know there was a council project that you enjoyed doing and did a tremendous job in that Till started.
Yes.
Would you like to tell us about that project?
She started and had a hard time doing it too. Nobody wanted to listen to her, and it was just as hard on the volunteers that she got to go there. It was started at the Barrett Junior High School, and we were to go there to help what they call the underprivileged children. Now the Junior Barrett High School school sits on Grinstead Drive, and what they call the school district isn't in one end or one side. It went in a periphery. The circle enlarged, and we had children that came from down on Washington Street, and then we had children that came from Cherokee Gardens. And so you had a varied number of pupils there from different backgrounds and different homes, and we were to help the children who were falling back in school. They weren't as bright as the others. They couldn't keep up. And some were, there was nothing wrong. They were just a little bit slow. But it was such a pleasant project. And I got to meet so many nice people, made friends that I still have to this day, and I cherish them. And I was sorry when the project broke up. But of course, people get older and they resign, and the others who came in didn't have the same feeling for the program that the
was
ones who
was there a
little
trouble with the school finally? I mean, they get a new principal who didn't really understand
they
it.
Got a
That's
new,
really
new
what
principal,
broke it.
Yes, and that wasn't too interested in the volunteers because it took a lot. It had to work both ways. The counselors that we had then were very interested in the project and went out of their way to make it comfortable for the people who came there. And I was really sorry. There was another program that the council did that was such a terrific project, and that was they went down to the, it was then called the City Hospital, who had a psychiatric ward, but they didn't even have a decent room that the people could come into when they left the ward. And I think the women from the council went down there and scrubbed and painted, did this physically. They didn't hire it. They did it physically, scrubbed and painted the walls and decorated the windows and everything. And went there every week and gave parties for the people.
I've heard many compliments from the staff
yes.
on that.
Yes, it was a beautiful program. What's her name? Is Joseph the
Dorothy Joseph?
Yeah, she worked hard on that project. I remember her. There were a lot of. I just happen to remember her name. There were a lot of women in there.
I think Sylvia Shapiro was very active there.
Yes, later, but
she
was one of the earlier ones. Yes, Sylvia worked quite hard on it. And then I think it was finally taken over. The hospital got big enough, and their women got interested and formed an
auxiliary
of their own from the hospital, and I think they took over the project.
Well, Ann, you'll be interested to know.
Yeah.
But guess who's back doing it now? The Council of Jewish Women are back doing the psychiatric.
Is that right?
They've asked us to come back.
Well, I think that's nice. Shows that, I guess they didn't do as well at it. The auxiliary. I think it was the smallness of the group that went and the closeness of the group and the volunteers who felt that they were going to a party each week when they went to the...
Certainly must have given the volunteers a good feeling inside.
But I really love the school project because I don't think there's anything nicer than anybody can do while he's here on this earth to promote a child.
Yes.
I think it's even a better project than this one, although I like them both. But there was one little girl over there, and the strange part of it was she told me she was 16 years old. She had lost out in school. And that she thought she was going to quit, and they're allowed to quit when they're 16. And then when school, and I tried to talk her into not quitting, to go on with it. And then she told the counselor, she says, I don't remember the lady's name, but if you see her, tell her that I'm going to go on to school.
That's the greatest reward.
It is.
It's wonderful.
And it was amazing the way the children would attach themselves to the volunteer. And much as you tried not to, you got involved with them. I'd buy them shoes and give them car checks when it rained so they'd come to school. But it was fun. And I
enjoyed the child got a lot, and it's good you got something out of it, too.
Well, you know, no volunteer is any good unless she enjoys the project and gets something out of it on her own. Otherwise, it's a chore. This way, it's fun.
Oh, it's bad then.
Mm-hmm.
And do you remember what were the important buildings in town when you were a child? I seem to be skipping with you.
Important buildings that are torn down now, you mean?
Or those that are still up and those that
are
down?
Well, the one that came to mind real quickly when you said important buildings used to be the Carter Dry Goods at the corner, I think it's 7th and Main Street. And it's now going to be a museum.
Natural History Museum.
Yes.
It's interesting.
That's one. And see, when I went to the girls' high school, which we only had one high school in Louisville at that time, and it was located at 5th and Hill, and I was always fascinated every morning passing St. James Court. And I'm so happy to know that they're not going to take that away because I thought it was such a beautiful place with the two lions on the front that you entered. And there are a lot of beautiful homes that surround it, but and I don't know, I think the mayor, Mayor Sloan bought one right across from there, from the Central Park, they called it, which was a beautiful place. Could get a little more police protection, take care of them when they're down there. But there's so many of the things with the expressways and all that tore down a lot of buildings. And I was happy that they, that the, that was a church or seminary on the corner of First and Broadway that became the Louisville Community College, because the architecture in that was so beautiful. Also, the church that remained on Broadway near Preston, on the north side of Broadway near Preston, that has all this Gothic architecture, and it still stands as a landmark. A lot of the things have disappeared to make way for progress, I suppose.
And early in the interview, you were talking about the ghetto, quote, mm-hmm. quote,
and I didn't know it was a ghetto then.
Well, where the, let's say where the Jewish people lived.
Yes.
It really wasn't a ghetto. It was where the Jewish people lived.
Yes.
Roughly, what were the boundaries?
Well, it was like Preston Street, Market Street, to out Preston, maybe as far as Walnut Street, Madison Street. And because I went to school at Floyd and Chestnut Street, they called it the George W. Morris School. And it was that area that, you know, that you walked through in the morning to go to school. We walked. We didn't have anybody take us in the
when
car.
When did that area, when did the Jewish people start moving from that area?
Oh, as soon as they made a few bucks. And they always wanted to better themselves. That was uppermost in their mind. They were never satisfied to stay in one place. And when they saw other places that were prettier and better to live in, although the streets on the buildings on Madison Street and Walnut Street, which is all, I think that those are all mostly there. It's all hospital now.
Yeah.
And they were nice looking homes, you know, better homes in those days. But there was always, I don't know when they say, the word ghetto now has connotations, but as I think of it there, I don't think of it that way, see?
Well, it is European ghetto with
no
walls.
No walls.
It was a voluntary situation.
Yeah, well, there was no streetcars, no buses, no place where you could go for anything. And I think one of the first natural parks that we ever had, we had way back, I don't know, it's even before my time, I think, a man by the name of Jacobs became the mayor of Louisville. And what's out there now that they call Iroquois Park was called Jacobs Park.
There's a hill called Jacobs Hill out there.
Yeah, well, that was named for him. So that was one of the first. Of course, Cherokee Park was a natural park, but that was so far away, you know, from where we lived, it was too far to go.
Well, did y'all enjoy Jacobs Park at that time?
Yeah, well, if you could get there.
I mean, did y'all go sometime, like maybe you get a wagon or something and go out there, or a streetcar later and take your Sunday lunch
or
something?
When you talk about that, it's hard, maybe if I tell you that my mother died in 1905, and then, you know, the holiday, and it isn't a holiday, but it's the day they called Tisha B'Av, when everybody was supposed to go to the cemetery to visit the dead. And the streetcars at that time were running, but the streetcars, the Preston streetcar ended where the St. Joseph's Hospital is right now, which is Eastern Parkway.
That left you a lot of walking to do.
Well, there was too much walking. You couldn't walk because there was nothing to walk on. And there was a man here in town, he had an express wagon. So on that day, he used to sit out there. He would drive his horse and wagon out to Preston and Eastern Parkway and wait till the rest of the people came out on the streetcar, and then we got on this wagon and sat on these boards and bumped our way to the cemetery. So you see, it wasn't very pleasant getting any great distance, because when they had streetcars, they didn't go very far. And that was the city limits at that time, I think, when it ended at the, what is now Eastern Parkway. It wasn't anything then, it was land, you know. And all the cemeteries were out that way. They went out. Now they're going farther and farther out towards the east. The city has become quite large.
How large was the city then? Do you remember?
No, it must have been very small. I don't ever recall, it didn't interest me at that age. I wasn't interested in how many people there were. I was only interested in who was next door to me or something like that, but I wasn't interested in how many people there were in Louisville. Louisville's a nice city. I'm born here. I'm still here. I like it.
It's home.
And I think it's become a lovely city, and I think that we do have a beautiful Jewish community. You can have any form of religion you like, from the ultra-reformed, although I think they're all going back to the basics now. I think they're all...
And the relations, would you like to discuss the relations between the different, sects, the different congregations, the changes that have come over the years?
Yes. At one time, the part of Jewry that I came from, I suppose it was a sort of a snobbery that they couldn't help. The German Jews who came here, if you read in this book, The World of Our Fathers by Irving Howe, they came because they wanted to come. They weren't running from anything because they were well treated in Germany at that time, see. But the part that my family came from, they had to go in this Russian army. They lived under the Tsars. They had pogroms all the time. Aaron left there in 1914, and there were pogroms then yet.
That late?
That late that he still could recall. And they came under different circumstances, and the others came with wealth, whatever so-called wealth. It was better than what the others had. They came with nothing. And of course they stayed in their own little cliques, but all of that now has disappeared. It's just a question of which congregation do you belong right now, and it means nothing. You say you belong to this one, you belong to that one, see?
There was not much intercourse between the different congregations.
At that time, I don't think there were.
And now it's completely almost...
Well, it doesn't really make too much difference now. So you're Orthodox, or you're conservative, or you're Reformed. That's all. They just ask you which. And I don't think that it makes any difference, or at least I don't feel any
difference. Well, that's going to decide a change. I imagine, though, that's not Louisville alone. I imagine that's nationwide.
Well, formally, the difference between the Reformed and the Orthodox was that they did not go through the Reform did not go through the bar mitzvah ceremony with the boys. But I think now one little boy sees the other one, I think it started because he sees the other one have all these big parties and gets presents and he wants them too. So it went into the other. I don't know that it had anything to do with the religion. I think it was the children that wanted it and saw it because they were intermixed. They went to the same schools, whether they went to the same Sunday schools or not. They went to the same schools, see. Now, I remember at one time we belonged to the, when my children were small, we belonged to the Knesset, and that was very Orthodox, see. And when I started the children to Sunday school, we were already living on Douglas Boulevard, and I would take them down to Knesset. But there were so many children there that didn't live in their neighborhood and didn't go to their schools, and they felt strange. So I had to go to the other... Sure, I went to the Adith Yeshurun because the children they were in school with, their friends, went to Adith Yeshurun. So it had nothing to do with religion. We just went over there so they could go to the Sunday school with their friends. So that's why I say I don't think that it makes any great difference now. Maybe to some of the older ones, but I don't think to the younger ones that it has that. Jewish.
The way I think it is today,
yeah,
too,
it's
Ann.
Just
and I
Jewish
think it's a very fine thing they did
it
that way.
I think it is too. It was a little child shall lead them. I think it was the children that pulled. I know it, in my case it was. We stayed with the original ones because my parents had been with it and his parents had been with it. But I think the way it's become now, I think it's marvelous. I think look how many nice rabbis we've had on this. What do they call this program?
The Moral Side of the News.
The Moral Side of the News, and one of them always sits up there and helps disperse the money that's raised in the Children's Crusade. I think there's a general mixture. It's not quite as hard to be a Jew right now as it used to be.
You know, Anne, it's great to talk to you because you make everything so optimistic.
Well, thank
sounding.
You. Well, I don't like to look. I don't like to look back, and I don't look to look.
You're not going
to
like the next question.
What's that?
What do you think are the bad parts? You only see the good.
Well, I can't see anything bad in anything that has progressed. If it was bad, forget it. I always say I don't like to look back because while I'm not a biblical student, I still remember what happened to Lot's wife, and I don't want to look back.
You don't want to be salt.
No, I don't want to
no,
be
well,
a
I don't think
salt.
I really meant bad. I mean, do you see any clouds on the horizon for the Jewish people of Louisville?
Oh, I hope not. I don't even want to think
about
that.
Or is there
that.
Anything about the community that disturbs you?
Right now? I really don't know. As I say, just seeing in the paper this morning, why are they starting up this, he wants to reorganize the Conference of Christians and Jews. There must be some reason for it. I don't know.
Well,
why.
There's been a little talk about anti-Semitism
well,
starting over. Now, Mother, what do you think? Maybe, I don't know whether there's something going on that I don't know about.
There. Well, there is. You know, I said something to a man once. I went to see that movie, Garden of the Fina Contessa.
Yeah.
I think that's the name.
That's the name of it.
And it was a very sad movie. And as we were exiting, I saw two people there that I knew had been graduates of the Belsen concentration camp. And without thinking, I said, how could you sit through a picture like this, you know? And she said, it must be shown, it has to be shown, lest we forget. You must keep it in people's memory. And I think Dr. Berg's, I was there recently, the mosaic that he put on the wall of the, even a critic said one time that he says, kind of hard to say you enjoyed.
Auditorium.
Yes, that you kind of say hard to enjoyed the play, he says, when you looked up on the wall and saw that. But then that's a reminder that this did happen and it can happen again. And I think we have to be ever watchful, but I don't think we should be.
You don't feel a thing.
I don't
want to worry.
Oh, I know it's to worry about, but I think rather than to worry, we should be watchful.
I think that's a good
worrying
point.
is no good. They've got to be on the alert and stop it when it starts and not think that it's going to pass away as they did before. It's not going to pass unless you do something about it. And I think that their manner of bringing things in, instead of saying, well, skip and don't say anything about it, it's now talk about it, get it out in the open and let everybody hear it and see it. And then maybe they'd be too ashamed to go forward with it or make any noise about it. But I wouldn't want to be pessimistic about anything, I don't think. It's much easier to think that life can be beautiful, even if it isn't at times. But I know when my children went to school and I would have to go over and they'd get into fights on account of anti-Semitism. And I'd have to go over and remind the principal of what was going on. And they always cooperated. They were always very nice about it. They tried to do what they could because, well, you can't control people's thinking. So if you had a teacher who didn't like Jews, and not the fact that he didn't like it didn't mean anything, but he voiced it. He can think all he wants to. But I think we'll
always... Would you like to tell us about that incident?
Well, the teacher, one of the kids passed through the hall and he heard this teacher and another one talking and it wasn't meant for his ears. And one said, what do you think of Jews? And he said, personally, I don't like them. And my child got it in for him and then he kept on worrying with him until one day in the classroom... He was aggravating the teacher, and the teacher said, stop making an ass of yourself. And he says, well, it takes one to call one, and that started a war, and he took him to the office. And then he came to me, and I had to go back and explain to the principal how this thing got started in the first place, that it didn't just happen today in the classroom. And I said that this man has a right to his opinion. He doesn't have to love Jews. That's his right. But I said, I've handled anti-Semitism longer than my child. And I don't handle it this way, but I said he didn't know what else to do. So he got ugly about it. But I think he didn't punish him for walking out for anything that he did, but he may have spoken to the teacher and told him to keep his thoughts to himself. If he did, I don't know. He didn't run into it anymore.
And but don't you think this is always in Louisville for many years been more or less a very minor, the smaller percentage of the population's been overt?
No, I think it's there. It crops up from time to time. But I always ask him why are you angry? We gave you your religion. Is that what you're angry about? You're worshiping a Jew. And I said, the only difference between what you think and what I think is that we're still looking for the Messiah, and you think he was here and he's coming again. So why fight about it? Let's see who's right.
And yes, your husband came over, was born in Europe, and he came mm-hmm. over. Did he come over in about 1914, you said?
He came over here in April 1914, just before the war broke out.
Now, he came over not so much because of the army, or was it because of the pogroms?
There was someone in the know over there that was friendly with his father who knew that there was a storm brewing because the war broke out in August 1914.
I see.
And warned him to get out. And his mother told the father to go first. And he was afraid to cross the ocean. He got as far as France. And he wanted to stay there. And she said no, she wouldn't come unless he went to America. And he came on over. In fact, they found out afterwards that both he and his father had been called up for the army, the Russian army.
Aaron?
Yes,
and his father.
Because the war dragged on, you know.
Yeah.
And he would have been old enough to go. He wasn't then, but he would have been.
And was his father, when he came to this country, what did his father do?
I never could figure that out. He had a brother that lived in Chicago, and he came to him first.
Aaron's uncle lived in Chicago.
And then, I don't know, I never could find out how they ever got to a little place called Oconto, Wisconsin. And then his mother had a distant cousin in Louisville, and she insisted on coming to Louisville. Maybe I was calling him, I don't know. But it was my luck that he came.
That's nice. Then they went in the butcher business?
No. They were in some kind of in the shoe business or something, and they were dragging all those shoes by train down here to Louisville, and they got
the ones they had in Wisconsin.
Yes, the ones they had in Wisconsin, and they got out of somewhere here, 9th and Market or someplace like that, and they opened a shoe store, and that didn't go very good, and then they went to the grocery business. And that was at Hancock and Finzer. But then, see, he'd only been here when I married him. He'd only been here about 7 years.
Did Aaron go to school here at all?
Yes. Yeah. But he went there what they called the gymnasium, which was like the high school here. And they put him in, it was very difficult for him, see, because he was he was in his teens already, and
yes,
they put him into something like that. But he went to high school here. But it was too hard to do too much studying, you know.
Did he speak English then?
Not too well. I taught him to speak better. But his mother never did learn to talk. His mother was speaking, I couldn't speak Yiddish. I could always understand it, but I couldn't speak it. But when I married him, he came up with a mother and a grandmother who couldn't speak English. So I could understand everything they were saying to me, but I couldn't answer them. And in desperation, I couldn't teach them English. In desperation, I began picking up the Yiddish words and handing it back to them so I could make myself understood, and eventually I wound up speaking Yiddish fluently, and they never did learn English. So I kept on talking Yiddish, then I perfected my Yiddish by talking to them, for which I'm very happy. It's fun.
I would imagine you come to a country late, it's very hard
very
to learn.
Very hard. Very difficult.
It would be difficult.
I often wondered what would happen to me if I went into, imagine going into a country like France and trying to learn French enough to speak. But I think the trouble with our language is I think the children would pick them up faster if they wouldn't concentrate. Go back and get the grammar afterwards. But teach them how to speak
first.
Before you have to decline?
Before you have to decline and what case it is and whether you're saying him or her. And
I think you're right.
When, and German was always so difficult with their die, das, and der, you know, that you, they had neuters and feminine and... but it was...
It was a way that they don't teach right.
Well, I think they found that out during the war years when they sent the men over. They got their records and they started teaching them how to speak, how to say a phrase or I'm lost or where's the park or where's the bathroom or this. They taught them things like that instead of worrying about whether the bathroom was masculine or feminine or neuter or what to do with it.
And
yes.
Back to when you were a child, did most of the, and you were living in the neighborhood where all the Jews live mostly, was there a lot of Yiddish spoken down there?
Yes, yes.
Much English?
Very little, if they could. Only to their customers who couldn't understand Yiddish, they had to speak English or have the children translate for them. But I think that happens with all the foreigners, because at one time, I forgot when it was after the Second World War, that Selma Kling asked me to go, because it was the YMHA still down there on 2nd Street, to teach English to the new Americans that were coming in. And I didn't want them to know that I could speak Yiddish, because I thought if they knew I could speak Yiddish, they would come after me with the Yiddish and they wouldn't give me the English. And it was rather difficult to try to, especially if I had one of them in there that she could only speak Italian. And another one, she knew no English and she didn't know Yiddish, see? So I had to get one that could understand Yiddish and speak Italian that could translate back to this one, see? Because you almost had to be a linguist, and a linguist I was not. I could handle the English and the Yiddish, but that was about it. And that was the first time, which was a very good thing, although they probably didn't appreciate it. They had to learn to speak, to read and write English before they could become citizens. You know, that never was a requirement until after the Second World War.
Oh, you had to read and write before you
can become... You have to read and write before you can become a citizen now. In years gone by, they didn't do that, you know. Somebody would teach them just what they had to learn, and then they'd go up and